death is the medicine. We often think about medicine as a thing that staves off death, that keeps us from death, that battles death. And it's a pretty powerful thing to invert that and to think that death itself is actually the medicine.
This is the When You Die podcast. If it has to do with death and dying, we're talking about it. I'm Johanna Lunn, your host today.
With me today is Michael Hebb, author, speaker, provocateur. He is driven by the desire to make the world a more compassionate place. To that end, he has virtually hosted tens of thousands of people at the dinner table to change the world by providing a safe space to explore drugs and addiction, climate action, gender inequality, and death. Welcome, Michael. I'm so glad that you could join me today. I am delighted to have this chance to talk to you. So welcome to my dinner table.
Honored to be here.
Wow, you have done so many things. And I love the idea that you've used the metaphor and reality of sharing food to have great conversations about everything from gender equality, ecology, and death. It's a wonderful and brilliant entree into a lot of very difficult conversations and diverse conversations. So I'm wondering, what is your guiding principle for why you do what you do? Because each one of these things is, and more, we'll get to end of life community, is robust and deep and full. So how do you do what you do?
The mission statement came to me in my early 20s. And I knew that I was focused already on reducing suffering on the planet. That was just clear to me. Once you suffer deeply, I think you either, but there's plenty of different things you can do with it. But one of the paths is taking an interest in reducing other suffering, for sure. And I read this thing that Stuart Brand wrote, four words that Stuart Brand wrote. And Stuart Brand is, if you don't know that name, I'm sure you do, but the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, which in many ways fueled the back to earth, return to a kind of agrarian commune, do-it-yourself, back-to-earth movement. And Stuart wrote, "My client is civilization." And for me, that was very focusing. And that some people might hear that and say, well, that's very grandiose. It's not about its grandiosity. It's about the orientation. If you can look at each project and say, who's my client? Your client may be Microsoft, but is it improving the lives of people on the planet? And for me, that's always been, it's a no if it's not. And so very early on, I stopped working with brands and just started working with nonprofits and a lot of the work that I did, because it was easier to filter out that we were actually working on making civilization, improving civilization, on evolving. It's so ingrained, I wake up and think about how do I improve things on planet Earth? And sometimes that's hyper-local. It certainly does start with oneself, always. But it can be as simple as, how do I make this neighborhood more beautiful and aligned and vital?
I love that. I love that. So civilization is your client.
Yeah.
Making the world a better place. I'm with you totally on that one, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And I had come across this little statement that you'd said in an interview with Chase Jarvis. Said, if you want a mission statement for life, face your mortality. I love that. I guarantee you'll get a mission statement. That was such a wonderful, wonderful thing to say, because I think it's true. But your truth, where did the rubber meet the road in terms of your mortality?
I mean, I think the essence of that statement is one we can come back to, which is that death is the medicine, or death is medicine. We often think about medicine as a thing that staves off death, that keeps us from death, that battles death. And it's a pretty powerful thing to invert that and to think that death itself is actually the medicine. It definitely wakes people up. As far as for me personally, my life shifted significantly when my father died when I was 13. And he'd been sick for a while. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's when I was in second grade. So the last 7 years of his life were pretty fraught and very damaging impact on our family, as far as having good communication about his illness, about his, you know, impending death, how we felt about it, how we could plan for it, how we could honor it. None of those conversations were had. And so it ended up being a very shameful thing. But my dad was sick and dying and really destroyed my nuclear family ties and the extended family. And so I had to go searching for mentors. But before I did that, there was this particular day when my father died. And I talk about this a lot, but I think it's an important story that a lot of people can resonate with. It was Halloween, the day he died. And I went to school on that day, and I didn't tell anyone at school. I looked around and just, I think, made a pretty smart evaluation of the people in the room and decided that no one could hold the weight of my grief or the experience. And I didn't know actually how to access my grief. We act as if grief is just this thing, this button we can push, or this room we can walk into. But especially, I think, for men who are not taught how to access emotions, but are actually taught how to suppress and are messaged to repress emotions, grief's not that accessible generally. But I didn't even think that anyone could take the weight of the information. So I ended up going to school, and then I ended up going out on Halloween night like people do. And a 13-year-old kid who's a popular kid, like, you're going to be out causing trouble, you're going to be drinking, you're going to be teepeeing houses, you're going to be an asshole, essentially. And so there we were, being little jerks, and something was very different. I still didn't tell anybody, and there was this gap, this kind of skip in the music, in my consciousness, in my experience. I was no longer at the front of the herd, making the decisions about what we were going to do, being with my peers. I was watching them and watching myself, this new awareness, and then deciding that I actually didn't like either. I didn't like who I was with them, and I didn't like how they were behaving. And so this is one of these gifts that death can give us, is an awakening, a shift in consciousness. Of course, that awakening ended up creating a great deal of pain for a long time. And that's the suffering I mentioned, some of the suffering. And it was very painful to feel disconnected from my peers, because that's your whole world when you're 13, 14, 15. And I started to fill that pain and that gap between me and my peers with big questions about spirituality and mysticism. Got very interested in Eastern spirituality, got very interested in Christ, in Thomas Merton, in St. Francis of Assisi, in Thich Nhat Hanh, in Buddhism, in TM meditation. I started to call in mentors. Like, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher arrives. And from then until now, mentors have showed up for me. So that was really where that consciousness that there's something more to do with this thing called life than just go along with the herd or the flow or what was expected of me. That there was some maybe larger expectation to a much larger being or universe. And I guess I was born at that point as a kind of spiritual being, if you will.
It's true that death and those huge life-shattering moments, not always a mortal death, but big deaths, like even a divorce or things like that, that really there's like a crack in the universe somehow, and there is some clarity in that and incredible amount of pain. But in that is a certain kind of rebirth. I think that's amazing when we can see it and allow the pain to be there and wash over you and not push it away, but also be able to see that you're seeing is a remarkable gift.
For sure. I mean, birth is painful, right? We forget that. I mean, women don't forget that.
Really don't.
No, but birth is painful. And it always includes a death. Divorces are death, but so are weddings. A wedding is a death ritual. And it's the most popular death ritual other than birth. Birth is a pretty popular death ritual. Our non-parental selves die, and we're now responsible for another being. But when you marry somebody, if your single self doesn't die, your marriage will die. That's not the only thing that ruins or ends marriages, but it's probably the principal reason. Mm. And this is where the thing where people are like, no one wants to talk about death. It's like, you talk about death all the time. Yeah, you're always talking. Let me look at your Netflix, you know, recently viewed history. I bet you it's death, 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 laughs, death, laughs, like documentary.
That's really a great way to look at it. It really is.
Yeah, the bus has already left the station. People are like, you get people to talk about it. I was like, no, I don't get people to talk about death. They're talking about death 24/7, 365. I'm just giving them permission to talk about it in a personal and existential way, not just in a response to Hollywood. Mm. You know, or these other very commonplace, prosaic ways. We just haven't given people good invitations or good designs. Good design is really important. Hollywood is a very good design. Films, like the idea that on cellulose is printed this type of experience and then it's distributed first in these very heavy, unwieldy canisters and then projected. Like, a lot of effort has gone to get that message to people. And then if you think about the type of effort that has gone to create a death literacy to people, and the disparity between those two, there's no mystery as to why we don't talk about our own deaths. We have not spent the time, energy, money, resources, creativity around the delivery devices and the design and the scaffolding that goes into shaping and delivering a message. So it's no surprise to me that people aren't thinking about their own end-of-life wishes. And that's why we created Death Over Dinner. It's funny, we created a bigger problem the moment that we've launched Death Over Dinner, which is always great. You want your work to create bigger problems or to like put on the horizon the bigger issue that you need to solve next, right? And I think it was Samuel Beckett who said, he said, try, fail, try again, fail better. I love that notion, but we essentially invited everyone to this experience where we got them, you know, a million people have had death dinners, and we've asked them to talk about their end-of-life wishes and to inspire them to make a plan, yet there was nowhere good we could send them to make a plan. A lot of incredible resources like the Conversation Project or Advanced Care Directives in different states or the NHBCO, et cetera, a lot of great resources, but those aren't plans. Those are elements within a plan. Like, if I'm going to make a plan to go on a trip, it's going to include my airfare, you know, who I'm flying with, where I'm staying. I'm going to educate myself about the place that I'm going, right? And listen to some of the experts. I'm going to find some of the great hotels and restaurants and things that I want to see. I'm going to remember what friends happen to be in Rome if I'm going to Rome. And preferably, I'm not going to buy the ticket and make all of the arrangements the day before I leave, because it's going to cost 10 times what it would cost if I planned that a year ago. So same thing with death. Exact same thing. It's either like planning a wedding or planning a trip to Rome. And it is 10 times as expensive. And really, you miss the excitement of let's just wing it. That it's generally not good for weddings. Can be. Really pisses off a lot of people. And it's very expensive from a travel perspective, or can be. So we were like, wow, people need a place where they can go and they can create a simple plan well in advance of a death or while they're in the middle of an end-of-life event. So let's create a plan, and then let's make sure that all of those things are there. The best providers are there. They're on the site. And if you're like, hey, I need to know about ecological burial, the president of the Green Burial Council is going to be like, raise their hand and say, let me help you. And that's already happening. So EOL is a community. It's a simple planning tool, and it's a place with all of the best providers. And the top experts in the field have been contributing content for the last 3 years. And so we're not there yet, but we're hoping to be one element of EOL, to have it be like the Netflix of end of life, since we're talking about film.
And of course, we do hope that In the Realm of Death and Dreaming is part of your Netflix community there.
Of course, that's on the must watch list.
Excellent, excellent.
The trending, the top 10 in the world today on Netflix of death.
The Netflix of death, that's right. It's even more than making your plan, because you've got a whole section for healthcare providers to talk to one another, and all of these institutions up and down the coast and coast to coast that don't really know how their medical center and community of physicians want to approach death. Individual physicians have had varying success being able to be comfortable with the idea of death when they were trained to keep people alive. So this is a radical shift within the medical framework, and you've got a safe place where physicians can talk to one another and other members of the healthcare community. That's kind of amazing. I don't really know of another model like that.
Yeah, there's not when it comes to end of life. There are places that physicians can talk about symptom management, research, et cetera. But there's nothing as relates to end of life, which is the only prognosis that we all have, right? It's the only thing that is absolutely sure from a medical and from a human perspective. And one thing that's really exciting to me about EOL is we've, for the first time, are gathering medical directors and funeral directors in the same place, and everybody in between. And then on the outside of that, that's also included, are the planners, the insurance providers, the legal providers, the financial advisors, the end-of-life planners. And then you get into more the acute needs with the medical directors and the palliative care, but also all kinds of physicians and clinicians, to have them be in conversation with and visibility to funeral directors and vice versa, that isn't completely walled off like it's Berlin or something. And then on the other side of that is grief. And none of these people have been connected. These four main categories of planning, acute care, death care, and grief have never actually been seen as one in the same industry or one in the same community. And they suffer and we suffer as patients and humans by them not being connected, knowing about each other, sharing resources, sharing best practices, you know, even just smiling and winking at each other, right? Like, it's beautiful to watch a social environment, but also have it be very filled with functional, necessary providers, just things that we need.
It's true. They've all been in their own towers. I think it's very exciting to witness, you know, the emerging connectivity of all of these things. And it's, you know, that even goes beyond the death community in a way, as I feel like we're kind of waking up a little bit in the world and starting to see, particularly with COVID, you know, how we are really connected. Places can shelter themselves and flatten the curve and do all this stuff, and then one traveler comes in and boom, it's all up again. And you go, but you didn't, how did that happen? We were cool right here. Well, no, we really are connected. We are deeply connected in so, so many ways. And so to see the role of grief and setting a good ground of grieving for people when a relative is on their way out the door, to see how healthcare workers are impacted by working with death every single day and recognizing not just what best practices are of care, but what are best practices for caring for the caregivers. And, you know, and on and on and on. I mean, this whole wrapper is like a new little universe to bring them all together, to see how they've always been together, but in a very dysfunctional way.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of moral distress, the amount of trauma, the amount of suppression and repression, which causes disease in the first place, that is contained in this whole sector of life that is known about. I mean, if that were the case in any other sector, like if we dealt with all of these maladies in birth, we would have fixed it. If we dealt with all of these maladies around being a teenager or in your 20s or being retired, etc., we would have dealt with it. But we have, and I'm compassionate as to why we haven't. People are saying we need to stop death denial. And it's like, well, certainly we need to ease death denial and we need to become a death literate culture. But we're inherently biased to not want to think about our own deaths. And that's okay. Like, this is a mechanism that breathes. This is a heart that beats. It knows it is designed to do that thing. It doesn't want to think about the cessation of that. And that's okay. And we also, as humans, have a very basic human bias that often gets overlooked, is if we haven't experienced something, it's very hard for us to imagine that it actually exists. It's a type of our brain that is either developed or it's not developed. And it's developed via creativity when we've killed a lot of arts programming. It's not that we don't have to do the work around racism or we don't have to do the work around these things. Of course we do. But there is a bias that just implicitly exists in people. If they haven't experienced it, it's harder for them to imagine it. And so that's a larger issue of how do we create empathy? And it's not just built into us. It's there to be turned on, but our culture needs to support it.
That makes a lot of sense. Needs to be turned on.
Yeah. People talk about epigenetics. And the thing about epigenetics, we can turn up the bad epigenetics, or we can turn up the positive epigenetics that we've been given. We have this gift in our DNA, or we have this kind of curse in our DNA. And dependent upon what work we do, how we live and our behaviors and the work that we do into our own trauma, we turn on different parts of our epigenetic, our strengths or our weakness, you know, our kryptonite or our superpowers, right?
That's interesting. I have never really heard it put that way. And I mean, certainly I've thought a lot about the role of fear in death denial. And that's both a very primitive thing and also a very real thing, that we don't like what we don't know. We're uncomfortable. People are going on a blind date and they're nervous, they're scared, they're afraid because they don't know what is sure. It going to be like. And I think that death is certainly one of those things that we've not formed a relationship with, partly because we have really pushed it away in the past 100 years or so. I mean, I always come back to this example of my grandmother's house, because it was a family homestead in a rural area of Pennsylvania. And people were born there. Lots of people were born there. Lots of people died there. And the house was purpose-built. It actually had a little door in the parlor. It wasn't a living room then. That was rebranded after World War II. It was a parlor. And it was specifically for coffins and dead bodies to go out, because you never take a dead body out the front door. And so there it was. It was just always, when my grandmother, when her time to die was, she just lied down on the sofa in the parlor, mm-hmm. stopped eating and drinking, said, "I've had enough." You know, and pretty much that's what she did. And that's what her sister did. And that's what her parents did. And all the people that had died in that house did. It was like, okay, we're done. You know, unless they fell off a cliff or something, or some other dramatic way of dying. They more or less lie down and...
They're like high lamas, high Tibetan monks. We've done this thing of over-medicalizing death. And death is a community act. It's not a medical act. People like to blame the quote-unquote system for it. And I don't think it's that there's such a clear villain in it. I think as soon as we started to emphasize Western Cartesian ideals. It was invariably that we were going to land where we are. And it has been heightened by the fact that death has changed so significantly in the last 50 years and will never go back, most likely, to what it was. And that change that I'm talking to is the reality of announced deaths. So even though we look at your lineage and think about, I'll have my last martini and then I'm going to lay down in the parlor and maybe I'll read a little bit of Keats and then I'll be out. That happened only because somebody didn't say, you have a high likelihood of breast cancer because of this particular strain and maybe you should have a double mastectomy. And it didn't look like you have colon cancer and your chances of survival are 15%, et cetera. The idea of announced death has shaken us completely and we don't acknowledge it. People say, well, they're much better in India or in Mexico around death or the Aboriginal relationship or the Native American relationship to death. And it's like, you know, or Stephen Jenkinson, who's close to you. And it's like, yeah, that's absolutely true. There's a ton of indigenous wisdom, ancient wisdom, but none of those traditions have any ritual, wisdom, knowledge to how to deal with a terminal diagnosis.
Right.
8 out of 10 of us, I think, will die of announced deaths. That is a completely living on another planet experience around death. And of course we're messed up about it, right? Like, of course we're grappling. And of course we medicalized the shit out of it. Like, we did just put it all into a medical framework. And so to reclaim at least that last chapter, that last bit, into a community presence is the job that we're all doing right now. And we need to understand what happened and we need to understand why, and we need to be compassionate. I'm compassionate when your family doesn't want to talk about it, when your parents don't want to talk about it. We don't have the conversation. Like, well, one, why do you want to have the, no one wants to have the conversation. You know, we're going about it in many wrong ways. And so there's a lot of room for patience and sympathy and understanding. It's an exciting time, I think.
I think so too. So I'm just curious, at the moment in your life, what are you most passionate about right now?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about the future of death. And it's a funny thing. This is what my next book will probably be called, and I started to write it. But it's almost like this oxymoronic word, you know, turn of phrase. What is the future of death? And it looks a lot like the past. For me, I have to learn from the past. We're alive at a time when human bodies are being composted legally as a beautiful practice in Washington State.
Yes.
Right? We're alive in a time where Elon Musk is dreaming of sending people off to Mars where they will die on Mars. Homo sapiens dying on other planets. Like, what are those burials going to look like? What are the monuments for the dead on Mars look like? Like, this is a really strange time. And still there's people in Silicon Valley trying to defeat death or cure it. So that's fascinating. But I'm struck by the fact that COVID, it's a lot of things, but I think it is actually the fertile ground that the future of compassionate care will come out of.
Mm.
And I'm using the AIDS crisis as my binary example. My mentors in the end-of-life space were shaped in the AIDS pandemic. Ira Byock, Frank Ostasevsky, Katie Butler, even Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, deeply shaped by the AIDS crisis. It taught them so many lessons. It brought Buddhism and compassionate care into the center of end-of-life care, the very center. It wasn't there. And now what is going to come out of COVID? Because it is going to create the future of end-of-life care, of compassionate care. I think that the distinction, I think that the sea change is going to be doing away with decreasing, hopefully obliterating the disparities and the inequities when it comes to BIPOC and queer communities around end-of-life care. If COVID does that, it's already raised it up. We can't ignore it. End-of-life care for a person of color is significantly worse. We can't unsee that. We can't unknow it. So if COVID gives us that, if it democratizes dying well, then there's certainly no price or value you can put on that, nor the lives that we're losing. But it gives me hope. So that's where I'm focused right now.
Wow, I really look forward to the next book. It's fascinating to think about all of that.
Yeah.
It's like in death, there's birth, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think that there's some cultures who actually have their calendar as the circle, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think right now our calendar is more like a football game, right?
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, and of course you want to fight, win, defeat, you know, all of these terminology. When you have a linear system and you're shown a linear system and a linear calendar, of course it's about winning. The linear is designed around that, but the cyclical and the circular makes winning kind of ridiculous. And now we know that that terminology around end of life actually hurts us deeply. And we know that journey metaphors around end of life actually improve care and improve the experience of care. You can be giving the same care to a patient and tell them that they're on a journey or that they're battling or fighting. The medicine will do more for them, dependent upon the metaphor you're using, which as storytellers, we know this, right?
Yeah.
But it's pretty amazing to get it at the level of a clinician.
Well, words matter, right? Just like environments matter. Our body is constantly responding to the environment that we're put into. Everybody thinks everything's happening in your brain, like in your head, that your brain is your consciousness or whatever. But actually, we're completely wired head to toe for receiving and transmitting information. It's crazy. I mean, humans are not what most of us think we are. We're far more amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's terrifying to think about that for a lot of people.
Oh, I don't know. I find it exciting, but yeah.
Well, no, I mean, that's the Marianne Williamson notion that what we're afraid of is our power and our brilliance and our radiance. Mm. I mean, she said it best, but we'll see. The other thing is we haven't lived in a culture that is vibrating, is thinking on a high level, heart-based frequency at scale. And we may be getting closer to there, we may not, but we know if we look back historically and say, what happens when a lot of people are heart-based and they're together? And it's like, oh, you get the Vedas, you get the Upanishads. Like, you know, it's like, oh, that's pretty good.
Well, I think we are at one of those big historic moments. I think the turn of the last century to the 1900s was an interesting time from a theosophical point of view. It was an interesting time spiritually. Abstraction art came in, a lot of Waldorf Steiner stuff. It was kind of like there was some little crack and these little things came out of it. And I think that we are similarly at another kind of point where things are shifting. I mean, the fact that we're having this conversation, that you're even thinking about things like the future of death, these are really transformative thoughts. These are shift points. And I think our curiosity and our desire to learn more about death, partly because people have to.
That's my question, is it the dawning of the age of Aquarius Or is it the fact that boomers are getting closer to death?
Well, for sure, you know.
I hope it's both, or at least, or more one.
Well, I don't think you can take them apart. I don't
Good,
think
you can not.
Really separate them. But for sure, we're not our parents' deathbed experiencers.
Yeah, the silent generation gives way to the boomers. It's a very different type of psyche that has been empowered to ask for what they need and have the resources to pay for it. It's great. Whether it's a Kundalini rising or or just a lot of very self-expressed humans, we'll work with it.
We'll work with it. Well, maybe on that note, I should thank you very much for spending this time, and really look forward to another conversation one of these days.
Likewise. That was too much fun. Let's do it again.
Thank you, Michael.
This conversation is brought to you by the When You Die Project. From existential afterlife questions to palliative care and the nuts and bolts of green burial, if it has to do with death, we're talking about it. When You Die,